Oh, yeah. I'm a miracle. I mean, I put a gun in my mouth and almost blew my head off when I was 15, you know, because I was gay and Jesus hated me, I thought. I don't use drugs anymore. That's an absolute miracle. I wake up every day with a woman who either doesn't have the good sense to take off or who actually loves me, and I think it's the second one. That's a miracle. Miracles are not far off and rare. They're in our everyday lives, and all we have to do is be willing not to be cynical and to kind of look around with wonder and awe at the people in our lives and the places we live, and we'll see miracles every single day.
This is Phantom Hampton. Phantom Hampton is the podcast with stories from where the rest of us live.
You'll hear the whistle blow 100 miles.
I'm Reverend Dr. Katrina Foster, pastor of St. Michael's Lutheran Church, Amagansett, 486 Montauk Highway, Amagansett. And today is Tuesday, May 12th, 2015. I'm actually unabashedly a media groupie. Send me a reporter or a TV crew and I will show up. But not for myself. It's to get attention for my congregations in an attempt to reach as many people with the good news about Jesus as we possibly can. I was driving my wife to an appointment up Island one day, and we passed the statue store, and I said, honey, wouldn't it be funny if we put a big old dinosaur in front of the church? And she started laughing, and I knew I was onto something. Shameless attention-seeking behavior for Jesus. So I put on my good suit, my best clergy shirt. I grabbed my secret weapon, which was my, at that time, 9-year-old daughter, and we go to the statue store, and I walk in, and I introduce myself, and he says, oh, I've heard you on the radio. You're really funny. And I said, wait until you hear this one. We went and got the dinosaur. We loaded it on. You could take the tail off so it would fit. We strapped it down, and we got to the church, and all the church members were there waiting to help. And we have a two-sided sign out front, and I was like, what are we going to put? One of my members came up with this because it was a raptor. She said, are you ready for the raptor instead of the rapture? And the other sign, we said, we baptized, not lobotomized, bring your brain to church. Well, stained glass, there's a point to it. The original purpose of stained glass in Christian churches was to tell Bible stories to a completely illiterate populace. I grew up with the story of Jonah and the big fish in my hometown church. I can still see that stained glass window. What we have here are different symbols. You have the dive-bombing Holy Spirit, which looks like a dove. Over here, I always call it the dive-bombing Holy Spirit. Butterflies, of course, they start out as not attractive little caterpillars. They go into what looks like a deceased state, and then they emerge in new life, and so that is a symbol of resurrection. A spear and a tunic and drops that look like red blood, that would be from the crucifixion. The spear was punctured into his side to make sure that Jesus was dead. You have the triumphal entry, Palm Sunday. Then you have Maundy Thursday, where he celebrates the Last Supper, the Passover, with his disciples. Good Friday, he is killed, he is crucified, he is dead, Friday, Saturday, and then you have Easter, where the tomb is found to be empty. We were raised up in the church. Mama was a Sunday school teacher. My dad was on the church council. When I started acolyting at the age of 4, the big candles that were on the altar, they were too tall for me. So Dad made little candle holders that they used just for me on Sunday mornings, and I loved it. From about the age of 2, I knew the entire service, and I would sing louder than the pastor. But I knew from the age of 4 that I wanted to do what the guy up front was doing. I knew I wanted to be a pastor. I was pastoring a church in the Bronx, and I was there for a total of 16 years, doing battle with drug dealers in the neighborhood. They put a price on my wife and daughter's head at one point when I made it where they couldn't sell drugs anymore. I took away their ability to make money. They couldn't come after me directly because I was a white female priest. They thought I was a nun. I didn't care what they thought I was, but they couldn't come after me directly. So they put a price on my wife's head and my daughter's head. They couldn't come to church for months. I had a young girl who had been, she wasn't a member of the church, but she was in our youth ministry. She hid a pregnancy and gave birth and murdered her baby. And it was just, after a while, vicarious trauma builds up and it becomes more than, you know, our physical systems can really maintain or sustain. And so I started saying, okay, I've done a lot of good work here. I'm tired. God works this way in my life. When God is ready for me to move somewhere, God will make it very clear. And when that's not supposed to happen, doors just slam shut or nothing opens. So my wife, my daughter, and I took a spontaneous camping trip to Heather Hills. And so we pitched our tent. We had never camped before as a family. Pitched the tent and made it through the storm that night. And once it cleared, we looked out, and I had never seen a night like that since I was a kid down south. It was just gorgeous. You don't see stars like that in the city. So I said to my wife, the church in Bridgehampton and the church in Amagansett are pastorally vacant. They don't have pastors. And she handed me the phone and said, call the bishop. I called the bishop, and it was like a light bulb went off over his head, over the phone. He said to me, I don't know if they'll call a gay pastor. I came out and I preached here. They voted to extend a call to me. Nobody was sure if they would do that or not. And I gave notice to my congregation, and I started serving here July 2010. Well, about the age of 14, 15, I started figuring out that I was also a lesbian. Nobody ever has a straight path. Growing up in the South, in part of the Bible Belt, with Southern Baptist, you know, homosexuals were an abomination. And my very, you know, limited human understanding, I believed what I had been told. I believed the voice that spoke loudest and with the greatest certainty. Those were the fundamentalist Christian voices that quoted the Bible. I almost suicided at the age of 15. I became a full-blown addict by the age of 15, trying to escape. And I loved Jesus. I mean, I was a total Jesus freak, and to this day I am. But I knew that he hated me. And so it was very hard. And I went to a Lutheran college. I played softball and scholarship because I'm a lesbian, and I used the entire time, so I was not very good, actually. I had the potential, but I was just messed up the entire time. But I met a chaplain, Reverend Dr. Daphne Burt, and Pastor Daphne saved my life. She was the first pastor I came out to. She was the first female pastor I ever met. I had never even seen one of those in my life. When I hit bottom, she encouraged me, and she told me that even though I felt broken, God uses broken things, broken wheat, broken grain to become our bread, the broken body of Jesus to save us, and that God could even use me. I had been trying to run away, and I was trying to find other work. Nothing worked. The director of admissions for the Lutheran Theological Southern Seminary, Pastor John, used to come over and see me like once a month, all 4 years of college. And he just kept saying, you need to be a pastor. You're called to be a pastor. You've got to do this. And I kept saying, well, just buy me dinner and I'll listen to you and I'll ignore you. When I had hit bottom and when I was completely lost, I called him and I said, can I still come to seminary? Because I'd done nothing to apply. And he said, you could come for a whole semester and then apply, and it would be fine. So I went for boot camp, we called it. It's Greek. You learn biblical Greek. I'm a redneck. I can barely handle English. So here I am trying to learn this language. And I failed. And I left. I went home. I was like, clearly I have misjudged God's desire for my life. I'm going to go be an air traffic control supervisor like my dad. That's what he wanted me to do. Packed up my stuff and I was walking to the parking lot. I got in my car, my 1976 Camaro, and I was driving out of the parking lot, and David Peters, may he rest in peace, he was a man that I had gotten close to during the Greek intensive. He ran in front of my car and stopped me, and he said, "You can't leave." I said, "David, I failed." He said, "Yes, but I need you." Now, I had been such a mess for like 6 years at that point. Nobody needed me. You know, like, who needs somebody who will steal your stuff and help you look for it? You know, you don't need those kind of people in your life. So I went back to the seminary. I was there by myself. I found a job in a pool hall. I was a rack girl racking up, you know, pool games. Reverend Dr. Charlie Siegel mercifully taught the class again. I passed it barely the second time. It wasn't a straight line. I really struggled with whether or not to go and then whether or not to stay. I was at a function in the basement of a church on Christopher Street, and there was this really nice woman there, and I thought she was straight, beautiful, beautiful woman. She turned out to be a Greek, and we just hit it off. We were great friends. She came to my ordination. Pamela and I, we would hang out. You know, we were just friends for like 2 or 3 years. We were just friends. And then one night, I was dropping her off at her house. She lived in the Bronx also. And she gave me a kiss on the cheek, as she had done dozens of times. And she got out of the car. She went to her house. I drove to the stop sign. I parked the car. I turned it off. I almost passed out because I realized I was completely and utterly in love with her. And I told her that, and she ran away. She was like, "No, we're just friends." And so she disappeared. For 9 months, I have never prayed so hard in my life. I was miserable. I was forlorn. I was lost. I was, you know, every, you know, depressing adjective you can imagine. I was that. And it was just awful. So then we ran into each other again at the Lesbian and Gay Community Services Center. She said, I'm going to the convent. And she had been thinking that she should become a sister. In the religious order. She was thinking about that and exploring it. So May 17th, 1996, we go to this play, Marlowe, at St. Clement's. She wants to show me the chapel. She loves this little chapel that's there. So we go in, and she's showing me the chapel, and I kissed her. And May 17th, 1997, on the first anniversary of our first date, I spontaneously, it was not planned, but I spontaneously asked her to marry me. And then May 17th, 1998, we were married at that chapel at St. Clement's Episcopal Church. And in August of 2002, our daughter was born. And she's just one of the most awesome human beings I've ever known in my life. She's a great kid. So May 8th, 1993, at 11 a.m., I came out to my parents. They came to see me in New York, so they were on my turf. And we sat in my little kitchen, in my little apartment. I came out to them. I told them I was gay. Mama said, "What did we do wrong?" And I said, "Y'all didn't do anything wrong." And my father cried. And my father is like a cross between John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. So I had seen him cry one time before, and that's when somebody stole his .357 Magnum handgun. He was so mad he cried. So the theft of a gun and his daughter being a lesbian are the two times I've seen my dad cry. And then Mama said something which it will remain with me until Jesus comes back. Mama said to me, "Katrina, you remember Ted Bundy?" And I said, "Ted Bundy, the serial killer?" And she said, "Yes." She said, "His mama loved him, and I'm going to love you too." And I said, "Mama, I don't want to kill women. I would just like to maybe date one or two. But it was her attempt to convey the extremes that her love for me could endure. I'm not interested in right and wrong. I'm interested in faith and how that faith informs our discipleship, living out of that faith in Jesus Christ. When Martin Luther picked a fight with the Roman Catholic Church by nailing the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg Church door in Wittenberg, Germany, he messed with their ability to make money. So they were selling indulgences, which was like better than crack, heroin, and meth combined. I can sin and buy this piece of paper, I'm okay. You know, my Aunt Nellie died, I'm worried she's in hell, or maybe she's in purgatory, I can reduce her time there. And that theology gets recreated now through prosperity theologians like Joel Osteen and Creflo Dollar and all those charlatans on television. You know, we are saved through what Jesus did on the cross and in the resurrection. You can't buy that. It's a gift. It's bestowed on us. You can't buy it. Unfortunately, we have been undergoing such a dumbing down of our society. The idiot box, known as any screen that you sit in front of, a computer or a television or your phone, we just get dumber and dumber as we get lazier, and we expect somebody to tell us what's important. And what's important, apparently, is Kim Kardashian and her butt. The thing that unites us across generations, and I say this as a person of faith who tells an old, old story every single Sunday. I'm a person who is attached to a particular story. It informs my life. It teaches me what to value, and it teaches me how to relate to God. You need to know these stories, because after all the farms are gone and every single house out here is occupied during the season, and there's no longer firefighters and there's no longer EMTs because they can't afford to live here anymore, you need to know what was here before you. And it was a group of Bonnickers who came, and they worked the land, and they worked the seas, and they fed themselves and their neighbors, and they built a community. And you are the recipient of their work and their vision. You didn't get here on your own. You stand on the shoulders of many generations who came before you.
This is Phantom Hampton. Phantom Hampton is the podcast with stories from where the rest of us live.